7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Howdy, Croc Nation. Dr. Tommy and Ellie here with you with another amazing Croc podcast for the most amazing people on earth, our survivors slash thrivers on the other side of the computer glass, Angel Santana. Have faith, let it begin. Angel, what's happening?
On the midst of the Groundhog Day weekend, where Punxsutawney says we are going to have an early spring, I am feeling okay with those results. How about you, my friend?
I am excited about that, but I'm even more excited about today's podcast. Angel, do you like roller coasters?
20 years ago, yes.
Today's episode is going to be such a roller coaster, but it's not going to be just your standard average, you know, wood roller coaster with a couple of ups and a couple of downs. This roller coaster is going to be rock'em sock'em robots. It's going to have twists and turns and so much G-force that our survivor thrivers, their cheeks are going to be flapping. It's going to be an amazing podcast. I'm so excited about it. I actually have a story for you, Angel, and it's going to, but you're going to have to wait for it.
I like stories.
We're going to have to wait for it. So, Angel, you know what I'm all about when it comes to going to work, right? I'm all about the patient. We're all about our survivor thrivers. We're all about trying to inspire our fellow clinicians, our fellow colleagues to get to know their patients. And I came across this amazing article, which kind of gives a bit more scientific justification to what I already hold as a passion and know is true. And the name of the paper is Knowing the Patient as a Person in the Precision Medicine Era. And the name of the author, Dr. Roy Ziegelstein, he's out of Johns Hopkins. And the paper that I'm going to reference specifically was published in the Annals of Family Medicine back in 2018. And I just want to shout out to Dr. Ziegelstein. I've never met him, but what a wonderful paper. And I'm really proud to be able to use this paper to help our survivor thrivers, and more importantly, to help our colleagues see a different side of medicine, especially as things in medicine are changing at the speed of light. Your thoughts before we start?
I'm excited. I think that whenever you like to give an analogy or a story that relates to the topic, I think it always hits a home run because we can relate to it.
Oh, and the punchline is going to be significant. It's really a great story, actually. I'm so excited to share it. But let's talk about the paper first. So when I walk into a room, you know, the first thing I usually do is I try to connect with the patient, and I try to get to start. Like if a patient's receptive, and many times they are, it's not very hard. But sometimes it's like pulling teeth and people look at you like, what exactly do you want to know? And sometimes I'll say, hey, you know, I know everything about your prostate cancer, but I don't know anything about you. I know everything about your left breast, but I don't know anything about you. And I think that this is important because, and we've talked about this many times on this podcast, we as physicians are now leveraging technology to such a degree that we're almost becoming sort of robotic. Even our position in the room, we have our computer is now front and center. As opposed to the patient, we concentrate on that computer screen because in that secret box, you know, our patient's history, our patient's findings, our patient's laboratory results, our patient's x-rays, and we are focused on that data. We're focused on that screen to the exclusion of the patient. And this has changed so dramatically. And some of it for the good and some of it for the not so good. We've told the story of Dr. Peter Pascarelli when I was a kid and I had a fever and I had to go to the doctor. My mother threw me in a bathtub, washed my ears and every freaking inch of my body, threw me in some dress clothes and with a fever of 106 and took me to the pediatricians just so, I guess, you know, out of respect because in those days, you know, the doctor was God, right? And there was really nothing, you know, there was a huge divide between the doctor and the patient. and there was so much reverence that it was actually unhealthy. And then came the good old fashioned family doc, where they showed, you know, moments of humanity. They made house calls. They knew your entire family. In many instances, they would deliver you, and then they would deliver your kids. You know, they were part of the community. They were part of the fabric of their communities and of the people that were in these communities. And now, you know, we're getting to be these robotic docs, as I said, almost like artificial intelligence docs. And again, our new position is not looking at our patients in the eye, but staring at this computer screen. And they have done studies, and the studies have shown that patients feel left out. They feel that the doctor's not looking at them. They're looking at the screen. Their body position is turned away from them, and they have no eye contact. So imagine feeling so left out. You know, my, you know, remedy for this is to involve them in the screen, show them their data, show them their x-rays, explain their x-rays to them. But, you know, that's just my methodology. But in general, it's a problem. In the literature, Dr. Ziegelsten's point of view, he calls this the no-me experience, N-O-M-E, right? I told also the story of a doctor. I'll withhold his name so I don't embarrass him. But I went to go to a meeting with this guy, and he had his computer in front of him. And I don't even think we shook hands. I think I just sat down, and he never looked at me for the entire 30-minute meeting. And later I come to find out he wasn't taking notes about the meeting. He was actually playing Tetris. So, you know, that's to the extreme, right? But we know, Angel, from this podcast, and we know from the literature, and we've said it all the time, compassionate care is very important. And it's not just important for a patient to feel that they have agency in their healthcare. It's important for their successful medical treatment, and it's important to their eventual outcome. And it has been shown study after study that this is true. To treat a person, not treat a disease. And that's really the bottom line. And on the other hand, I don't want to minimize the medical advances that are just exploding all around us. And I call it at least the advent of omics, O-M-I-C-S. So as I said before, medicine is traveling at the speed of light. We now have the genomics, right? That means we know everyone's genetic code and what their tendencies are and predispositions to different diseases. We even have pharmacogenomics. We have proteogenomics. We have metabolomics. You say that five times fast. You have all of these omics that are again transforming the care of the patient, the cancer survivor, thriver. And I don't mean to say this is bad. Not at all. It's fantastic to be able to take a patient and deliver personalized precision medicine. That's the name of the paper, knowing the patient as a person in the era of precision medicine. So all of this stuff helps us as doctors, as your caregivers, as your medical team, I should say, I stand corrected, as your medical team, this gives us information to treat you as an individual. So we're not going to treat every lung cancer the same. We're not going to treat every prostate cancer the same. We're going to look at all of these omics, and we're going to incorporate this knowledge in the individual care of the patient. However, we can't abandon what we call the soft skills. The soft skills have to come in on the white horse, like the cavalry, and come into the fight to the rescue. And we need to go from the know me, N-O-M-E, to the know me, K-N-O-W, me. So we have to go from physicians that make the patients feel like they're not involved to not only are they involved, but their doctor knows everything about them. And this is a very holistic approach to medicine. And this, I think, is a good marriage between the technology, which are the hard skills, the high-tech skills, and the soft skills of being a doctor. I'd like to think that there's always going to be the art of medicine and not just the strict science of medicine. So these soft skills, they include our listening skills, how much we care, how much we explain and teach, and how much we know our patients. And to know a patient, you need to make an effort to get to know the patient personally. And here is an idea. How about we marry the soft skills with the hard skills, the omics? And we have to recognize, Angel, that knowing the patient as a person is what allows physicians to use an understanding so of the genetic and biological uniqueness of a patient to provide maximum benefit. So you can have all the omics you want, the genetics, the genomics, all of the other omics that I can't pronounce, but you're not going to be able to fully leverage that knowledge unless you truly know your patient as a person. And we have to develop what we call, or what Dr. Zigelman calls, the personomics, right? Person omics within the other omics. And I'm going to just finish the paper by just reading a couple of quotes and going through one of the tables, and as far as helping my colleagues actually do this if they're not doing it already. So physicians and physicians in training must be taught the most effective, efficient, valid, and reliable techniques to understand each individual's psychological, social, cultural, behavioral, and economic situation, and how it impacts the person's experience of health and illness. They must learn what questions to ask to understand each patient's values and goals, health beliefs, and personal preferences. So, for example, the content area, the patient as an individual. So, here's some thought questions. How does the condition affect the patient? How do the patient's circumstances and experience affect the condition and treatment of that condition? So a sample question would be very simple. Angel, tell me about yourself. Number two content area, the patient's life circumstances. How do the patient's domestic, social, and work situation and previous experience of healthcare impact the condition, self-management, and lifestyle choices? Again, lifestyle choices. Many illnesses are our choices, our lifestyle. So here are some of the questions you can ask. What did you do for work? What do you like to do in your free time? Describe your previous relationships with physicians and what you are hoping for in a doctor, patient relationship with me. Content number three, the patient's concerns. How do the patient's health beliefs, concerns, and preferences affect engagement with treatment? The question would be, please tell me your questions or your concerns. And the patient's needs. How does the patient's need for psychological, social, spiritual, or financial support affect treatment? The question would be, tell me about your family and who is important to you in your life. And don't make assumptions. What assumptions are you making based on a patient's appearance or other personal characteristics that may affect the way you diagnose them or the way you treat them? And then finally, to conclude the paper, the science of genomics, proteomics, and the other omics is still in its infancy. And the power that each will have in allowing future physicians to provide individualized care to patients has not yet been realized. This is also true about the techniques involved with understanding each patient as a person, i.e., the personomics. This will only be accomplished if personomics is viewed as being essential in order to appropriately apply an understanding of the patient's genetic and biological individuality to the care of the patient, and in that way, to move from know me to know me in the precision medicine era. Angel, your thoughts about the first part of the podcast?
It goes back to what we're here for, and it's always it's like 101. It's knowing your patient and knowing who you're with. We've talked about it on, we've been over 140 episodes. It's just getting to know your patient and the patient getting to know your doctor. Really, plain and simple.
Plain and simple. And Angel, here's the punchline. You ready?
I'm ready.
I missed it. Something happened this past week that I missed. And I'm the king of this, right? This has been like, I am the patron saint of getting to know your patients. And I missed this. So my shout outs go to my nurses and my nurse practitioners. So there's this very lovely 80-something year old lady that we're taking care of. And I spoke to her yesterday and I got her permission to use her name. I'm only going to use her first name. I'm not going to use her last name. Although she did give me permission. Her name is Walda. And Walda is the cutest, most amazing woman. So sweet, so courageous, so wonderful. And I walked into the room and basically, and Angel, there's nothing else I can say other than I just missed this. So I don't know why I missed it. I mean, maybe I just was kind of viewing her like in the paper we just reviewed. I was kind of making assumptions about her because she was 80 or 80 something. And she didn't really connect with my jersey or anything. So I didn't really think much about it. But the nurses and nurse practitioners said to me, you have to come into the room. We have to show you something. So I walked into the room. I saw Walda, who I knew, right? Because I saw her for her consult. And they go, you're going to need to sit down for this. Walda shows me a picture of a World Series ring. Walda's father, his name was Walter Brown. His nickname was Jumbo Brown. And we're going to get into this in a second. Played baseball for the New York Yankees in the 1930s and won a World Series with the Yankees. So I'm thinking, okay, I'm sitting down. They're dragging me out of my office for this. I got a million things to do. I'm sure I was distracted, and I was certainly not ready for what I was going to find. So, all right, your father played for the Yankees. Great. He played for the 1932 World Series champion New York Yankees. He got a ring, right? Cool, right? But I didn't even have an idea of how much juice was in this fruit. So Walter Brown, nicknamed Jumbo, was born April 30th, 1907, and died October 2nd, 1966. He played Major League Baseball from 1925 to 1941. And if you just skimmed his stats, you would basically blink and miss it. He was not, you know, a Hall of Famer. He was not an All-Star. He was 33 and 31. That means that he won 33 games and lost 31 as a major leaguer. He had a 4.07 earned run average, which means he allowed, on average, 4 runs per 9 innings. And he had 29 saves, which we're going to talk about in a second. But when you dig, and I dig because Walda helped me, and we both dig together, you found a hidden treasure underneath about 3 foot of sand. And with Walda's help, here's what I found. So finding number one, by far the most referenced feature of Jumbo Brown was his weight. Jumbo Brown was named Jumbo Brown because he was a big guy, but they were relentless back in the day, in the 1930s, in the 1940s, in the 1920s, everyone. And I mean everyone, from the players to the coaches, to the fans, to the press, to the hot dog vendor, to the peanut salesman who would throw the peanuts, you know, across the stands to sell his peanuts. There was a morbid fascination with Walter's weight. And to be honest with you, his weight wasn't horrible. He started playing ball when he was about 190, and I find this to be hilarious because it's actually a medical factoid that I find, you know, to be such an old wives' tale. So Walter had his tonsils taken out after he played his first year of ball and gained 68 pounds. Now, Walter didn't gain 68 pounds because he lost his tonsils. He gained 68 pounds because Walter probably, you know, was not taking care of himself, but that's neither here nor there. But of all the references, and Walda shared all these references, and there's dozens and dozens of references that go back to the, you know, to the papers from the 1920s, the 1930s. Every reference makes a count of his weight. So Jumbo was a big boy. I mean, he played between 240, 280 pounds, probably. I think his top weight when he was ending his career was maybe 290. But let's think about this for a second. Angel, who's my favorite? Well, he's not on the Mets anymore, but who was my favorite player on the Mets?
Was it? Well, we talked about Bud Harrelson, so it's not him.
No, I mean, I'm just, it's really a question. Vogelback.
Vogelback,
so
yes.
Vogelback weighed 270 pounds. Cecil Fielder, 260 pounds, and he probably weighed 290 pounds. Vlad Guerrero Jr. goes in at 240. Vlad, I'm telling you, you're not 240. Let me tell you something. You're 280 if you're 1 pound. Molina was playing at 260. Poppy Ortiz was probably playing about 280. Jonathan Broxton, 295. Bobby Jenks, 270. Tommy Hunter, 255. All of you Yankee fans out there, your savior, CC Sabathia, he was playing at 290 pounds. He's the only Major League Baseball player I know who needed to have a heart stent placed while he was still playing professional baseball. So Jumbo Brown, you know, by the way, wasn't that big of a guy. I mean, he was a big guy, but I guess back in the day, people were smaller, and boy, they focused on this guy's weight. But Angel, how do you think he felt? You know, you and I have been struggling probably since we came out of the canal, you know, with our weight. Imagine how he felt that everyone made reference to his weight and didn't really make reference to him otherwise. He probably had a hard time finding uniforms to fit him. When he would get traded from team to team, you know, it was probably a pain to get him fitted for a uniform. Everyone concentrated on the one trait that was really not relevant to who he was as a person. Number two, what I found out, who he played with. He played with the immortals. He played with the baseball gods. Like, I'm going to start with Garrick and Ruth, but I mean, there's hundreds of, I shouldn't say hundreds, but dozens of Hall of Famers he played with and against. I mean, he would go fishing with Babe Ruth. This guy, who he played with, his experiences. We're number three, World Series and pennants. I told you about the ring. He's got a ring from the 32 Yanks. I think he also played for another World Series Yankee team. I don't know if he got a ring or not. I don't know if he was on the roster. And he got a pennant, so he got a championship ring with the 37 Giants. He was there in, I believe, the 32 World Series when Babe Ruth supposedly called his home run and pointed to the stands, and when asked later and said, "Jumbo, did the Babe really call that home run?" he would say, "Absolutely. I was there. I saw him do it." So, I mean, this guy was unbelievable. The other thing, you ever hear of the term journeyman? Walter was the consummate journeyman. He was a Chicago Cub. He was a Sarasota Gull. He was a Cleveland Indian. He was a New Orleans Pelican. He was a Gulfport Tarpon. He was an Omaha Cricket. He was an Oklahoma City Indian. He was a Jersey City Skeeter. He was an Indianapolis Indian. He was a Newark Bear. He was a Cincinnati Red. He was a New York Giant, and he was a New York Yankee. Number four, Walter was a trailblazer. In the day when pitchers pitched the entire game, sometimes they would pitch double hitters, there was no such thing as a niche pitcher. There was no middle reliever. There was no closer. There was no relief pitcher. Walter was one of the first trailblazers as a relief pitcher. He spent most of his career coming out of the bullpen. 2 years, he led the league in saves. He we think of closers and relief pitchers now as being glamorous, as being the absolute cardiothoracic neurosurgeons, of baseball. We think of Mariano Rivera and the mystique of Mariano for the Yankees. We think of Edwin Diaz coming out with the trumpets blaring and the singing and the fans jumping up and down where you feel the entire stadium shaking. Walter Brown was one of the first to ever do this. And the most important thing is the significance of him as a man. After he got out of the, baseball, he worked for Grumman during the war. So for the war effort, he owned a sporting goods store. It was called Jumbo Brown Sporting Goods and Fishing Tackle. He was a journalist. He wrote a sports column. He was a toll collector. He was a game supervisor for Jones Beach. He was a local celebrity. He was loved by everyone. And by all accounts, he was the best storyteller that ever lived. And imagine the stories that he had to tell. Imagine all the buses he had to go on when he was going from city to city, from Shreveport to Omaha. I mean, when he played in the minor leagues, riding all night, playing all day in the heat of summer, the things he must have saw, the people he must have met, the stories that he must have had to tell. And now we're going to go full circle, right? We're going to come full circle and we're going to put it all together. We're going to put the paper together. We're going to put Walda together. We're going to put Jumbo Brown together. And we're going to talk about his significance of the significance of him as a father and the significance of how this information could make me take care of his daughter better. So, number one, he was married, had a kid, got divorced, that or his wife passed, or one of I believe he got divorced. Then he was playing for the Giants and he fell in love with the Polo Grounds nurse. That nurse and him married, but they weren't allowed to get married because they both worked for the New York Giants. And one of the guys, I think the security guy, his name was Sarge. How cool of a nickname is that? I wish my nickname was Sarge. Only one guy knew that they got married and he kept it a secret. So for the one last year that he was playing for the Giants, he was married and no one knew it. A year later, my friend in 1941, our friend Walda is born. So unfortunately, she never got a chance to see him play professional baseball, but she got the advantage of hearing all these stories, right? She got to watch him tell every one of these stories. She mentions getting up in the middle of the night if they had a dinner party or had people over, and she would sneak like between the rails of the over by the stairs, and she would lay on her belly and she would listen to these great stories. She watched her father as a pillar of the community, right? So he was like a local celebrity. And she must have felt like she was like a little princess, born into the royal family of Long Island. And his second love, I mean, I guess his third love besides his kid and his family. First love was family, second love was baseball, third love was fishing. He would take her on his boat. He always had a boat. They would go crabbing, they would go fishing, they would bring fresh bluefish. And he'd gut them and he'd fillet them and he'd throw them on the griddle with a pat of butter and they would eat the fish, or he would make gumbo from when he was playing minor leagues. He learned how to make gumbo in New Or in Louisiana. And Walda, is telling us all these stories, right? So I first meet this woman, I missed it. I missed all of this. She was in her 80s, as I said, gave me no indication that she related to the jersey or was interested in sports. But with the nurses, when the nurses brought me in, and again, I'll say it again, I'm sure I was busy, I'm sure I was distracted, and I know I was not prepared for what I was about to learn. And to watch her eyes, Angel, light up like the brightest star, to watch the joy in her heart transform her entire being back to that little girl, to watch the pride beam and ooze from every pore of her body, and to talk about the Holy Grail, the World Series ring, that ring that's in a lockbox in some bank that she invited me to go see. I mean, that is the juice of what Dr. Zigelman was talking about. This is what makes what we do so holy, because now with that connection, and it was at that moment, Angel, that exact moment, that moment when everything comes together, that moment of crystallization of Dr. Zigelstein, in case I mispronounced his name during the podcast, I apologize. Dr. Zigelstein's paper and my new bond with Walda, that I finally realized something that I thought I already knew. It's the power of getting to know your patient, the power of Personomics, the power of the soft skills of medicine, the power of the human connectivity. And there are two things I know to be true, Angel, and I'll end here. I will end by telling you, I know Walda will triumph over her cancer. And number two, my nurses are getting jumbo brown jerseys. There's no question about it. We're all going to get jumbo brown jerseys. Angel Santana, have faith, let it begin. Your thoughts?
You know, it's true. The saying is, you just don't know. You don't know who you have next to you or near you until you know. And you know, I don't think you missed it, in my opinion, because as we have discussed many times on this platform, you're only as good as your staff. So your staff got it, and you did it as a team. You may have not gotten it in the initial start of it, but your team got it. So in essence, you all received an amazing treasure. And I think that it's remarkable. Awesome story. I have really no words other than that, because my mouth just dropped when you said who he was.
Oh man. So listen, I always end the podcast by thanking the board of directors and the whole thing. You know, I love you guys, but I'm not dedicating this to you guys today. I'm there to get it, dedicating this completely to Walda and to Walter Brown, her dad, and also to Roy Zigelstein. Dr. Zigelstein, I am very sorry that I mispronounced your name. It is Zigelstein, Department of Medicine, Johns Hopkins University, Annals of Family Medicine, 2018. Please forgive me and thank you for this really important article. Survivor Thrivers, you all have a story to tell. You guys all have the same value and all of the same important, amazing information to share, the same as Walda shared with me. You have to share with your doctors. Never feel afraid to do that. Even if your doctors don't ask you, why don't you tell them? Why don't you tell them something about you? Why don't you allow your doctors to get to know you as people? Instead of the know me, let's get into the field of know me. If your doctor is looking at his computer too much and not looking at you or ignoring you and not letting you feel part of the process, tell them, tell him or her, nurse, doctor, whatever. Make them look at you, make them get to know you, because when they get to know you, that will empower them to use their technology, to use the omics to treat you better, to give you better care, to give you individualized care, to give you a better outcome. On behalf of the Kroc organization, the Kroc board of directors, to all our amazing survivors/drivers, we end this podcast the way we end every podcast, by giving you a blessing, by wishing you all a long, healthy, happy, and cancer-free life. Angel Santana, God bless you. We will talk to you next week. Peace.